multiple Pentagon personalities.
You smell that? Napalm, son. Nothing else in the world smells like that. I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Gomer Pyle, USMC. Starring Jim Nabors as Gomer Pyle.
Son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash.
Film in this school is about combat. There are no points for second place.
The Pentagon has a whole A-team of people to manage its many personalities in the movies and on TV. One of them is a colonel deployed in Hollywood. When the mission is media relations, who's the top gun? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 10th. That Top Gun says Hollywood doesn't always play fair. Also today, the Iranians are testing more missiles. The U.S. Senate says no to cuts in Medicare payments. The vanishing bees, does that mean fewer blueberries on your table? And Pakistan and democracy, that and all the news. State television says Iran has again test-fired medium and long-range missiles in the Persian Gulf. It follows Iran's test of 9 missiles yesterday, including one officials claim is capable of hitting Israel. Today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice warned the U.S. would defend Israel if it's attacked.
We will defend American interests and defend the interests of our allies, and we take very, very strongly our obligation to help our allies defend themselves, and no one should be confused about that.
Iranian officials say the tests are meant to show Iran's readiness to strike back if attacked. After a 9-month break, formal 6-party talks on ending North Korea's nuclear program resumed today in Beijing. Disagreements over North Korea's delayed declaration of its nuclear activities had put the discussions on hold.
Congress has made the president's policy on foreign surveillance legal. The new terrorist surveillance bill known as FISA cleared the Senate yesterday.
This vital intelligence bill will allow our national security professionals to quickly and effectively monitor the plans of terrorists outside the United States while respecting the liberties of the American people.
The American Civil Liberties Union says retroactive immunity provisions in the bill will kill 46 lawsuits pending against telecom companies for wiretapping. President Bush's advisors are recommending a veto of a bill that would have nullified a cut in Medicare payments to doctors. Might not matter. The measure has cleared the House and Senate by veto-proof margins.
Oil slightly up in Asian trading, $136.42 a barrel. The Dow fell 2%. It stands at 11,147, and the S&P opens at 1244.
Looks like a positive open on Wall Street in about an hour and a half's time. But we're talking about who would you like to have dinner with? World leaders only, please. If you had a chance to eat with a world leader, who would it be? Don't tell us the menu. Just tell us who you'd eat with.
I'm Robin Berman. I'm calling from Briarcliff Manor, New York. And although I'm a news junkie and really interested in international affairs, I'd like to have dinner with that sexy Frenchman, Nicolas Sarkozy. Have a great day.
It'd be hard to do better than Sarkozy, but in terms of interest and news value, perhaps having dinner with Pervez Musharraf would be more interesting. We're going to talk with a filmmaker who did a documentary on exactly that kind of a dinner. 877-8-MY-TAKE, The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. More missile tests from Iran. What are the ripples throughout the region? So far, oil markets are holding steady, and there's been fairly measured reaction around the world, but we'll have all the details in just a moment. Meanwhile, two important stories in the Bush administration's efforts to fight and apprehend terrorists, a big victory in Congress on the one hand, on the Foreign Surveillance or FISA bill, passed by a very wide margin. But in the courts, it's quite another matter. A setback for the Bush strategy there. Federal Judge John Thomas Hogan of the D.C. District Court, Federal Court, has given the Department of Justice some marching orders. Drop everything in a matter of weeks and give 270 detainees held at Guantanamo Bay their day in court. Shana Cotterdahl is head of the Guantanamo Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Shana, Judge Hogan's order is one in a series of court decisions which seems to have created something of a tipping point for the Bush administration regarding this whole venture in Guantanamo. Is that where we stand right now?
You know, it is kind of amazing to hear a federal judge saying that in these cases. One of my colleagues who argued before Judge Hogan a day ago said that, a day in court in the Guantanamo cases is really kind of a precious thing, meaning we haven't had much of them in the last 3 years. And that really pretty much summarizes my feeling. We haven't gotten very far in 4 years. In fact, really, it's like a time warp. We're almost exactly where we were 4 years ago. And it's not an accident. The government strategy has always been to delay the time when they'd be called to account, when they'd have to defend with real evidence before
right.
an impartial judge.
But it seems that this decision, this decision and some others means that clock is actually running out in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, we've always said that the government wanted to run out the clock on these cases, meaning that they wanted to leave the mess of Guantanamo to the next administration to clean up, just like the Iraq War. And I think Judge Hogan showed that he's not going to allow that to happen. He said that I'm not only concerned but suspicious of the need for further delay in these cases. Really an amazing thing for a judge to say.
So it's conceivably possible that the administration will go, okay, here's the evidence, and present that within the time frame, and then we would have some actual trials here. It's also possible that the administration would just say, all right, no evidence, forget it. And then I presume there would be some pretty short hearings. What happens now, and can it possibly happen in any sort of expedited way? I mean, there are 270 cases here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we think it absolutely can happen pretty quickly. I mean, we proposed to Judge Hogan that in 10 days the government has to turn over the records of these little military panels that they ran just after the previous Supreme Court decision in 2004. You know, the way habeas corpus works, typically you would, if you were locked up in the Tower of London, you'd slip out a note to the court saying you were wrongly held, and the government has to come in and explain why they've held you, and that explanation is called the return. And what we're fighting now is really about, when is the government going to give us those returns? There are about 200 cases filed already, and in half of them, the government has never formally explained to us why they're holding our clients.
Now, one of the suppositions that the government has, made public, I mean, I suppose it has little standing in court, but certainly one of the practical problems for the government seems to be that there's no place to send these detainees, even if a judge were to release them tomorrow. On the one hand, the countries of origin maybe don't want them, and any place that they might go would be dealing with individuals who have probably been fairly significantly radicalized by being at Guantanamo for a matter of years. How does that figure into this process?
Well, I'm always skeptical to hear this sort of argument about radicalization. Most people leave prison more broken than angry. But just to give you a sense of it, okay, so there's 270 men left there, and the government says they'll only charge up to 80 in military commission. So that's a maximum, which means there's 200 men there who, never should have been brought into Guantanamo and will be, released eventually. Out of that group, somewhere between 30 and 50 of them are in this refugee position, meaning that they are from countries, their countries of citizenship or places that routinely engage in torture or other abuses. And this is, definitely a mess that's going to be left for the next president to clean up, because the solution to it is going to have to be a diplomatic solution. And while we are working, sort of very busily with other countries that traditionally take in asylees, Scandinavian countries, European countries, they all say to us, look, we don't want to clean the United States' mess up for it. You guys have to take some step in order to clean up this problem too. And that, I think, is going to mean, maybe taking some of these refugees at Guantanamo into the United States. And only then will some of these European countries reciprocate and back up their criticism of Guantanamo by opening the doors of their countries to some of these men who can't be sent to their home countries.
Shayna Condidal, thank you. Shayna is head of the Guantanamo Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's conceivable the Bush administration may take their own preemptive action. There were reports last week that there are discussions to shut Guantanamo down.
And this has been an ongoing discussion. You're right. Reports of the intensified discussion among officials. There's also intensified discussion today about what's happening in the Middle East, given the latest report from the Iranian state press that, again today, the Iranians were test firing missiles. And this comes following yesterday. They announced the Iranian Revolutionary Guard fired at least 9 missiles, which state official boasted could hit Israel. At least one of them could. The test triggered, of course, swift reaction in diplomatic circles and nervousness in the world economy. And for more, we go to the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams. Good morning, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Now, those missiles went over the Gulf. Is there some real message there, or some message of perception the Iranians want to enforce?
Well, I'm sure perception is a big part of this, because I think Iran is feeling rather beleaguered at the moment. You'll recall that it was just a few weeks ago that the Israelis mounted a large test run, an exercise out into the Mediterranean, which it was pretty much all but officially acknowledged was a test run for a bombing raid against Iran. And I think Iran feels that it needs to make sure that its defenses are in good order, and also that it can display its ability to hit back if circumstances dictate. So this is why we've seen the timing of this latest set of exercises. They're not unusual exercises. They've been similar ones held in the past, and none of the missiles that were tested this time around, as far as we know, were particularly new.
Now, of course, the Iranians knew that firing the missiles was sure to get a reaction. But help us here. What's really important? Is it the act of firing the missiles, the claim the Iranians are making that they can hit Israel, or the reaction, the swift reaction, let's say, from Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, today saying that the U.S. would support back Israel should it be attacked?
Well, I think what Condoleezza Rice was saying was almost a statement of the obvious, that of course, if there were a situation in which Israel was under attack from Iran, it goes without saying that America would spring to Israel's defense. Though it's also worth pointing out, of course, that Israel possesses upwards of 200 nuclear weapons of its own, and in the words of a very prominent Israeli military historian, has the ability to turn Iran into a nuclear wasteland, something which the Iranians know only too well. I think this is very much about perception. This is about Iran saying, you know, we do not want to be pushed around. We want to be taken seriously. We have this capability, and this capability can, if required, hit out at our enemies. Whether or not they actually possess the ability to hit Israel proper is slightly open to doubt, but certainly they're developing technology all the time, which makes that more and more possible. But it is a way of them saying, look, if you're going to attack us, whether it's you, the United States, or you, Israel, if you're thinking of attacking us, we have ways of hitting back.
But there is a real casualty here. Today, the Financial Times has a scoop. It's reporting that Total, the French oil giant, is going to pull out of a huge investment that they were planning on making on a Iranian gas field. That's just going straight to this jittery world economy we're looking at right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, everything that's happening at the moment is conveying the impression of the Gulf as a very dangerous and uncertain place in which to do business. And perhaps it's not surprising that a company like Total decides that it's simply not worth the risk at the moment. It probably was struggling to find banks that would be willing to participate in a venture of that kind.
Although, Paul, it's certainly conceivable there was a quid pro quo, because Total is heavily involved in negotiations in Iraq with the United States. And, of course, the U.S. is happy to have the appearance of sanctions against Iran with this Total story.
Sure, John, absolutely. And, one shouldn't imagine that or assume that Total's decision would have been a purely commercial one. There would have been all sorts of other factors involved. But this does, in a way, touch on a whole other area of pressure, which is the mounting commercial and diplomatic pressure, which is precisely what the Americans, the British, and others want to heighten against the Iranian regime in an attempt to persuade them finally to abandon the process of enriching uranium, something that the Iranians have been absolutely determined not to do.
Paul Adams, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you. Paul Adams, BBC diplomatic correspondent.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's July 10th. It's Thursday. And as many of you realize, we do ask a lot of questions on The Takeaway. And the question today is, if you could eat with a world leader, dinner, lunch, breakfast, who would that person be? If you could eat with one of those world leaders, who would that be? We want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And I'm also wondering if any of you have ever seen the movie Apocalypse Now.
You have to have men who are moral. And at the same time, were able to utilize their primordial instincts to kill without feeling, without passion, without judgment, because it's judgment that defeats us.
After having seen this movie, you might think you understand the Army and what it's like to go to war, but Lieutenant Colonel J. Todd Brazil says not necessarily. Welcome, Lieutenant Colonel. What's wrong with Apocalypse Now?
Well, thanks for having me on, Ms. Udoji. I get to say Brando's a tough one to follow. there's nothing wrong with Apocalypse Now. It's an interesting representational piece of a war movie that was one particular director and writer's vision of how they saw the war. I don't think there's anything wrong with that movie.
Okay. Army Lieutenant Colonel J. Todd Brazil, you work in Hollywood at what's called the Media Relations L.A. Division. Now, you help movie makers make realistic representations of men and women in the Army in the movies?
Yes, ma'am, I sure do.
And so how many scripts do you read a month?
Oh, gosh. It really depends. Hollywood has its own version of a surge every year also, sometime beginning around the fall, lasting through their pitch season and their pilot season in the spring. And then it sort of slows down in the summertime where our principal work is in documentary filmmaking and music videos, video games, long-form radio programs.
So you're really embedded, is what you're saying, in what's going on in Hollywood. In the Valley of Elah, that's a movie that you have some issues with. Can we take a listen to the tape and a clip of it, and you'll let me know what you think went wrong here?
I'll be glad to.
I hated it over there. Sleeping tents, no toilets, no showers, no toilet paper. Use your hand. I couldn't wait to get out. After 2 weeks here, all I want to do is go back.
Lieutenant Colonel?
Yes, ma'am.
So what's your thought on that portrayal of the military in the movies?
Well, that clip is representative of some soldiers' experiences when they went into Iraq and in Afghanistan, indeed, for the first time, before any sort of logistical support was there, and that's a very realistic representation, that clip that you played.
Does Hollywood sometimes get it wrong? Because that's basically why you're there, right?
Well, that's about part of the mission. I mean, the principal reason there is that we're there is to serve as the Army's voice and sort of face to the West Coast. We're sort of a full-spectrum public affairs office where we deal with everything from media relations to our work with TV and movie and radio. So, I'd like to go back to that clip that you just played. I'm not in a position to judge whether or not these are good movies or whether or not they are the clips that you're playing are representational, because those two clips that you played are very specific pieces. But taken on the whole, neither represent the Army of Vietnam nor the current Army of today's generation of young men and women who are serving their country.
Well, certainly, Colonel, there's a wide range of images that appear in the American media of the U.S. military. We kind of teed them up at the top. I don't know if you heard. We had Gomer Pyle in there, who's a Marine, of course. There's a Top Gun, Tom Cruise, you know, who's a naval aviator. And then we had a bit from Apocalypse Now. Does the Army and the Media Relations Department, you know, like that kind of range? Does Gomer Pyle bother you? Or do you think that kind of all publicity is good publicity, sort of the old Hollywood adage?
Well, we're not Hollywood, and I can tell you that not all publicity is good publicity. Publicity that tends to reinforce stereotypes for any particular group is dangerous in whatever its form. But I'm happy to be part of an organization that ensures people's rights to their artistic vision. Because we have a particular program with the accuracy of a given movie or a director's penchant towards sort of hyperinflating stereotypes or...
Give us an example. When you say inflating stereotypes, give us an example of a movie that you think overall perpetuated those kind of stereotypes.
Well, the first one that comes to mind is Brian De Palma's Redacted, which we had nothing to do with. That's probably the most overt one, where the director himself stated unequivocally that he is anti-military and that this was intended to sort of rile people. On a sort of much, much lesser degree, a movie such as Mr. Haggis's In the Valley of Allah, that movie went a great deal towards sort of looping military justice system and the military investigative services into one block of people who are interested solely in conspiracy and cover-up.
Lieutenant Colonel J. Todd Brazil fighting those stereotypes there in Hollywood. He's in Army Media Relations there. Thank you. Now we have headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello there. 28 minutes past the hour. Iran has tested more missiles overnight, and Condoleezza Rice is saying the US will defend its allies if they're attacked. Chinese police have detained 82 people suspected of plotting to sabotage the Beijing Olympics. 40 years after denouncing policies that barred African-American doctors, the American Medical Association is issuing a formal apology today for more than a century of discriminatory policies that excluded blacks from participating in the group. Army Lieutenant General James Dupic has said that Congress that Iraqi security ground forces will be able to stand on their own by the middle of next year. And Forbes magazine says that Tiger Woods is on track to become the first billionaire athlete in another 2 years. In Sudan, 200 gunmen ambushed peacekeepers in Darfur yesterday. Seven people were killed in fierce battles that lasted more than 2 hours. The attackers outnumbered the peacekeepers nearly 3-1. Six-nation talks have begun about North Korea's nuclear program, and they're back on today in Beijing after a nine-month hiatus. The new round of talks is focused on verifying the North's own account of its efforts to dismantle its nuclear program. And China has released its limited edition Olympic-themed 10 yuan bill. People were waiting in line for hours before the banks opened. And for those of you that don't speak Mandarin, I'm very excited, said the man. It was here since 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and I'm very excited and happy now that I've got the new note.
Sounds like an iPhone fanatic. And that replaces the Mao picture on yuan, right?
It does, yeah. And you can actually see the new national stadium nicknamed the Bird's Nest. Now, 10 yuan is about $1.50.
The Bird's Nest?
We'll put it on our website.
Thanks, Femi.
Yeah, you're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. This just in from the Labor Department. The government says new filings for jobless benefits fell last week. Okay, you've got a table for two at the Four Seasons, all right? And joining you is a world leader from anywhere in the world. Who would you want to join you for dinner? A world leader. And the reason we're asking that is for actually a very serious and legitimate reason. The question of who shall rule in Pakistan is a deeply emotional debate for the people of that country, and the ripples of that debate erupt into world headlines on a daily basis. That's no surprise. It's a debate about religion. It's a debate about the military and democracy. Here are some Pakistani women voices in the middle of that debate.
We are against the army and their allies, the mullahs. We want to make it clear. Without the army, the mullahs cannot rule this country. They are the ones who are keeping the army in power.
And here is the voice of the Pakistani army, General Pervez Musharraf.
Why didn't democracy function here? First of all, there was no democracy at the grassroots level. We still were maintaining the colonial period of administration through a district commissioner, deputy commissioner, and a superintendent of police running a district. The people didn't have the power.
This visceral debate over the soul of politics in Pakistan is quite literally dinner table conversation. They are scenes from filmmaker Sabia Sumar's documentary Dinner with the President, A Nation's Journey. She's one of Pakistan's few female independent documentary makers in a country where women's traditional role is to stay at home and questioning authority can very much be dangerous. She joins us here in the studio. Sabia, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting
Congratulations on the film. It will air this fall, October 28th, on PBS. A dinner conversation with the president to talk about the future of your country. That's the simple premise, but that's about all that's simple about this film, right?
I guess so. I think it's very complex in the sense that it sort of takes you all across the length and breadth of Pakistan and asking the question of how democracy will come to Pakistan.
How did you think that a dinner table conversation could be a forum where deeper truths might emerge, both from the leader of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, and the other people at the table who debated, including Musharraf's mother?
Well, I'm a filmmaker and not a journalist, so, I'm always thinking of a film in scenes and how those scenes will tell more about the person I'm talking with and how that will reveal different things about the character. So I decided to have a dinner setting because it's kind of disarming and it kind of takes you beyond a conversation that you see on television news or, you know, stuff like that.
What does come out in the conversation, which I think is very profound, is that whether you're talking about the army or the mullahs, the religious authorities, so many people in Pakistan believe that they're saving the country for democracy, that in some sense they're stepping in and taking control because if left purely to democratic forces, mistakes might be made. Musharraf says that in some cases, and of course the religious believe that they should have the power to control democracy. What do you make of that?
I think the question really is that, you know, Pakistan doesn't have a democratic tradition at all. It doesn't have a class that represents the values of a democratic system. It's mainly a feudal country, and feudalism has nothing to do with individual rights at all. So I think that's the main difficulty, which is why you have so many different power struggles, you know, at play in Pakistan. And the word democracy is quite empty when you look at the country and you see how it actually runs.
Were you surprised at how disarming Pervez Musharraf was at dinner?
I was a bit, actually. Yeah. I was.
He's a charming fellow.
He is, and very sincere. And it was very good to have his mother and his wife there as well. And that kind of gave us a sense of his background and what's important to him in terms of values.
And no food tasters or anything? I mean, it was very informal. And you really do capture an actual moment.
Mm-hmm. I hope so, yeah.
And also in the movie, there are so many actual moments because you talk to such a wide breadth of the community. You talk to the mullahs, you talk to the truck drivers on the street, you talk to some of the poor folk who live in rural areas. When you look back, which character really spoke to you in a way that was surprising?
Can I say two characters?
Sure. Two characters.
I think for me, the most interesting was the truck drivers discussion because they were really transparent and they came through so vulnerable. And that's what I understand of my people. That's what I understand of the people of Pakistan, that they're honest, truthful, vulnerable, and just caught in the web of corrupt politicians.
And they said it was all about class. In fact, one of them looked at you and said he wanted to be like you. He wanted to be educated.
Yes. And I think that's really poignant. I mean, that's the truth. That is the truth, because if they just had the opportunity to have the kind of education that I did, they wouldn't be in the place that they're in, and they wouldn't be supporting the mullahs. You know, it has a lot to do with economic deprivation.
And they didn't see politics having anything to do with bridging that gap either.
No, not at all. It was about education. It was very clear to them that if the state provided that kind of support, then they would, you know, be on the other side.
Well, finding that common ground in Pakistan, that common experience and common point of view to share a vision for the future is one of the themes in your movie. And let's hear some of the voices that do project very, very different points of views. Here are some of those mullahs you talked about a moment ago.
According to the Islamic principles, the women should give more attention to their homes. We give respect to the women.
What do you make of the mullahs' voices speaking for women like yourself?
Well, as you can see in the film, or you will see in the film when it's aired, that, you know, I took that whole discussion as a debate between myself representing a feminist position and the mullahs representing their own value system. And I felt very strongly that I have the right to live in my country and to live on my own terms, so there is no way that I'm going to take their dictate as the whole truth.
One voice of the passionate debate in Pakistan over who will rule. That's Sabia Sumar. Thank you so much for being with us. Sabia Sumar's film is Dinner with the President, A Nation's Journey, and it airs on PBS October 28th. You know, I think her next film should be driving in the truck from one end of Pakistan to the other, because those drivers were great characters as well.
They were fascinating, and she did an amazing job of weaving all of their stories together to give you a good representation in about 50 minutes of really what's going on in the political thought across the spectrum there
in
Pakistan.
To look forward to this fall.
We're going
to
give you an update right now on the Veep Stakes, the 2008 Veep Stakes, where you can log on to Facebook and find our game. And a big surge for former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. His value on the Veep Stakes has tripled in the last day. That means lots of you are betting on him.
And Webb is
John
dead.
McCain's.
I had a lot of money on Webb. Boy, I lost it
and
all.
And he's gone?
Yeah, he's gone.
Huh. But then also gone is Alaska Governor Sarah Palin.
Webb is up.
She
but he's
was
out.
The leading contender to be John McCain's Veep.
On the Democrat side, for a second day, you're predicting Barack Obama will pick Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius. She's edging out retired General Wesley Clark, but for how long? It's all in the Veep Stakes at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
You know, sometimes making a change in the world is a matter of some very big ideas getting mixed up with some seemingly silly and small gestures. Today, Christie's auctions off a kind of silly little cast-off memento from John Lennon, his scrawled lyrics for this song, Give Peace a Chance. John Lennon gave the written lyrics to a 16-year-old woman named Gail Renard back in 1969. Gail and her friend had climbed up a fire escape to see John Lennon and Yoko Ono, who were in the middle of an 8-day publicity stunt they staged in Montreal. They called it a bed-in. John and Yoko in bed and on camera as a war protest. Long before YouTube, Lennon envisioned his anti-war message spreading like a viral marketing campaign.
You can only tell how an advertising campaign is going by the reaction. It's like we sent out the initial packet of soap powder 6 months ago, and we're getting replies from the consumer now.
But teeny bopper Gail Renard wasn't so interested in war protests as she was getting next to a Beatle.
I never thought I'd get that far. I'd been a Beatle maniac since the age of 10, and I thought, I'll never get to see John Lennon. But when we got in, the rest happened from there.
The rest was the creation of the song, Give Peace a Chance. Renard was there during the bed-in, and at the end of it, Lennon decided he wanted to compose and perform an anti-war anthem. Young Gail Renard was in charge of the tambourines and making sure the lyrics were legible.
He obviously had written it at some point before because it was in his head, and he took a large piece of cardboard and a magic marker and wrote it down as a cue sheet. But then he decided it wasn't big enough, so he asked me to write one that was twice as big, and we did a swap. He ended up with the ones I wrote, but he gave me the other ones and said, with that and something else, it'll be worth something one day.
Well, Gail put the memento away as a personal treasure. But Lennon's odd publicity-hungry anti-war protests were not welcomed back in 1969, even though the song Give Peace a Chance went on to become a hit. Lennon had a famous argument with New York Times war correspondent Gloria Emerson back then. It was featured in the documentary The U.S. versus John Lennon. Here's part of their conversation. Lennon speaks first.
If I'm going to get on the front page, I might as well get on the front page with the word peace.
But you've made yourself ridiculous.
To some people, I don't care.
If it saves lives. You don't think you... Oh, my dear boy, you're living in another nether.
Well, you talk to...
You don't think you saved a single life.
Reporter Emerson had just returned from the bloody battlefields of Vietnam and wasn't impressed with John Lennon's stunt. But the question of saving lives lingers in the middle of another long war, long after Lennon's bed-in. Gail Renard's treasured lyrics gained value over time, and today at Christie's Auction House are expected to bring in $400,000. Gail, now a TV broadcaster in London, will donate some of the proceeds to charity, including an organization called War Child, perhaps making good on Lennon's promise to save lives from his silly publicity stunt so long ago.
I'm not that attached to the, you know, sort of to objects. I'll always have the memories, and the memories of John and Yoko, and there are lots of photos. So I'm really thrilled that other people are going to enjoy them now.
The memory's intact, the song known the world over today, Memories and a Promise, on this day, Beatles Day, this morning.
That is such a vivid story. Standing there with the tambourine as John Lennon is writing down the lyrics. I'd like to have been a fly on the wall there.
And Lennon got the last word in that argument with Gloria Emerson.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Thursday, July 10th. We have some headlines for you from Femi Oke. Hey there, Femi.
Hello. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour, for the second day in a row, Iran has tested long-range missiles in the Persian Gulf. Turkish officials have four suspects in custody in connection with yesterday's shooting at the U.S. consulate in Istanbul. More than 1,000 people have fallen sick in the recent salmonella outbreak, and the Senate has overturned the Bush administration's cuts to Medicare. The number of people who filed for unemployment benefits last week was down by 58,000, but when you adjust it for summer jobs, the numbers for the outlook for the country's labour market still look pretty bad. The Prime Minister of Turkey is in Baghdad for talks with Iraqi leaders. They're expected to talk about strengthening ties sustained by the Kurdish PKK rebels who've used northern Iraq to launch attacks on Turkish soil. A lawyer for the family of JonBenet Ramsey says there are many people in the country who owe the Ramseys an apology. They've been cleared of any involvement in the child's 1996 death thanks to new DNA testing. And finally, scientists say they may have found a way to predict earthquakes. Seismologist Paul Silver has been running tests inside the San Andreas Fault.
What was surprising, we saw a big change 10 hours before this magnitude 3 earthquake.
And by sensing these changes hours before the earthquakes occur, scientists hope to develop warning systems that could save lives. They're very excited. They're saying that earthquakes like the major one in central China, they may well be able to predict an earthquake of that size, that magnitude.
That would be extraordinary.
And would save thousands of lives. They're very excited about their new discovery.
Thank you, Femi. Well, it wasn't exactly an earthquake, but it was a dramatic scene on the floor of the Senate yesterday as Ted Kennedy came back to the Senate to cast a vote on the Medicare bill. It was important for the passage of the Medicare bill, but it was symbolic in the sense that Ted Kennedy, a sort of hero of the left wing in the Senate, was coming back despite being on chemotherapy and having just had surgery for brain cancer, came into the chamber. But the drama was that was just one scene of drama going on Capitol Hill yesterday. There was a bill, the foreign surveillance bill of the Bush administration passed. The Medicare bill, as I said, passed by a veto-proof majority. And there was plenty of talk about oil prices and what Congress can do about that. Joining us to sort all this out and to give us a sense of what it was like when Ted walked onto the Senate floor is Todd Zwillick, a reporter for Capital News Connection in Washington. Hi, Todd. Thanks for joining us. Pretty dramatic, huh?
Hi, John. Good morning.
Let's begin with that dramatic scene of Ted Kennedy. I mean, you could hear the noise and the sound and just the hero's welcome that he got. He was brought in for a very specific reason, though, correct?
Yeah, he was. He was brought in to vote on the Medicare bill. It was an interesting moment because the Senate, 99.5% of the time, is a place of high decorum. So for someone to walk on the floor and get not only a round of applause on the floor, but the galleries stood up, were applauding, it was really quite remarkable. Democrats all gathered around him, sort of rallied around him. Quite a few Republicans came over to shake hands and give him hugs, too. You're right. Kennedy was on the floor to vote on this Medicare bill. They were blocking cuts that are in the law. But they're budgeting gimmicks in Washington, John. Go back to 1997, kind of a shell game of how you balance budgets. And one of the ways they did it was cutting doctors' payments under Medicare every year. This year it was 11%. So every year Congress has to come back and do what's affectionately known as the doc fix. The doc fix means we scare you into thinking you're going to get cut by 11% or 15%, and then at the last minute we save you. You get a small update. Sometimes you get only 0.5%. This year I think they got 1.4%. That was the last minute Medicare drama, 2 weeks overdue. The current payments expired on July 1st, but they're going to do a retroactive fix.
Todd, it wasn't much of a drama on the foreign surveillance bill. Boy, those Democrats who were complaining months ago about the Constitution being in flames over domestic surveillance policy of the Bush administration, they seem to have just come out of the woodwork to ratify the Bush policy in this new bill, including the retroactive immunity for telecom companies.
Well, it seems like they made a decision on this, John. You know, most Democrats believe that their only real vulnerability in the upcoming election is national security. And it seems like a decision was made to take this one off the table. People have probably been reading a lot, hearing a lot about frustration on the left, on Barack Obama's left, about him moving to the center too much. Well, all candidates in general elections move to the center. This was part of that. And if Obama's going to move to the center on an issue, take national security off the table so that he can't be criticized for being extra weak on national security, well, the Senate Democrats, by and large, have to go along because they have to support him. You can't have 100 cats, or 40, 51 cats in this case, all going in different directions. So they decided to take this issue off the table and go into August convention and go into the November election, hopefully with national security at least having supported a program that most Americans think is key.
He's our man on the Hill. Todd Zwillick is a reporter for Capital News Connection. Thank you, Todd.
John, imagine you're a bee.
Ooh, whoa! It's pretty noisy in here.
In the middle of that swarm, it'd be incredibly crowded, and you'd be slammed in next to your sisters.
A lot of women around here.
A lot of women, hard-working women, because they're on a mission to pollinate everything they can in sight.
Where'd they go?
Tree, bush, and plain sight. And imagine that. They're gone. Silence. Vanish. Without a trace. Scary for the bees, scarier still for farmers trying to grow our food, billions of dollars worth of food. Dennis Van Eagelsdorp has been hot on the trail. Good morning, Dennis. Any closer to figuring out what's happening to the bees?
Well, we've been working on this for about a year and a half, and We certainly rule. We don't have one smoking gun. We have some leads. We sort of think that there's a sort of the equivalent of a bee flu finishing off colonies. In the first instance, we thought it was Israeli acute paralysis virus that didn't come from Israel. It was just named after someone who found it in Israel. Now we think it's probably just more generic flus. The question is we don't think it's the cause, but maybe the consequence. So the question is what's breaking down the immune system of the bees, allowing this bee flu to get a hold?
And that's something that you, Dennis Van Engelsdorp, who is the Pennsylvania acting state beekeeper, is trying to figure out, along with other experts at the annual Heartland Apiculture, and I said that right, Apiculture Society Conference, to figure out the problem here. And as you've said, this has been referred to as the colony collapse disorder, right? And there are theories all over the place, and you're talking about really a kind of AIDS for bees, potentially, right? That virus?
Well, that's right. We don't actually think the virus is the cause. So, like, AIDS causes disease. We think this virus is the consequence. And so how we're analyzing it now is we're trying to see what factors combine. So you know how we get a heart attack? Well, it's not just from drinking or smoking or eating unwell. It's a combination of factors. So now what we're doing is we've analyzed this huge set, and we're trying to figure out which combination of factors can predispose the bees to get the flu. What's breaking down their immune system, basically?
You've basically referred to this as just imagine losing one out of every cow in the United States. And the race to find out what's going on is because of the valuable pollinating, the critical pollinating that bees do. And in the absence of these bees, nearly half of the honeybees gone seemingly every year, how are farmers coping?
Well, it's actually beekeepers are really quickly able to replace dead out colonies. So if you have one remaining strong colony, beekeepers are able to split that in half and introduce a queen. Of course, that costs them a lot of money. And so they're able still to keep the numbers of bees up, but they're losing a lot of money. And we're really worried about these very large beekeepers that move their bees up and down the coast from Maine to California to pollinate crops, that they're going to go out of business because they're going to go bankrupt because they can't absorb these 50% losses year after year.
Are we feeling the effect right now in the marketplace? My last question.
Well, I can't really answer that directly. I know that the price of pollination has gone up significantly. So, say 3 years ago, an apple farmer would be paying $45. Now he's paying $75.
Wow.
In almonds, they're paying $65, and now they're paying over $150.
Dennis Van Engelsdorp, thank you. Dennis is a honeybee expert, Pennsylvania's acting state beekeeper, and he just happens to be the keynote speaker at today's 7th Annual Heartland Apiculture Society's conference.
I wish I was there. I used to keep bees when I lived in Virginia years ago. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on
that
today's show.
That explains a lot. Can
it
I
does?
Just interject?
Really?
You were stung a couple times, huh?
Yes, I'm so good with women. Send us your stories at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. We're talking about Iran, Hollywood, and the U.S. military and how the disappearance of bees could mean a crimp in your ice cream budget, babe.
Absolutely, because they're concerned about losing fruit to put in their flavors, or 73 Haagen-Dazs. Anyway, check out the website, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can see our timeline of selected movies and events connecting Hollywood and the U.S. military.
And here's the takeaway for today.
But you've made yourself ridiculous.
That's thanks to Soundcheck for that audio about what's going on the auction block at Christie's today. The lyrics scrawled by John Lennon of Give Peace a Chance.
And what world leader would you like to have dinner with? Dana, she called to tell us that she would like to sit across the table from...
Yes, good morning. Dana Franchitto from South Wellfleet on Cape Cod. The leader I would have dinner with, Hugo Chavez, because he's a riot. He's very funny, a bit flamboyant.
He's very funny, Dana says, Hugo Chavez.
Chucklehead Chavez. Big search for former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney on the Veep Stakes. He's overtaken Alaska Governor Sarah Palin to top John McCain's Veeps list.
And if you missed anything today on the program, you can catch it on iTunes and, of course, thetakeaway.org.
That's it for us.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.